they split their business into two major sectors, wireless and wireline, and then like 0.5% of corporate, whatever that is. But so in your beta table, you have three sections for telecom. You have wireless, which goes with wireless. Then you've got equipment and services. So which one would wireline go in? Services? What is equipment? Like manufacturing, the actual
manufacturing.
Okay. Now, how do you figure out the operating assets per?
Yeah, they give it to you. You do it. Otherwise, you have to base it on some other. What do they break revenues down?
Yeah. Just based on that. So whatever percent of revenues is also assets. Thanks.
Okay, I see we're fully in spring break mode. You know what I should do? I should forget to put this session online. Right? Should have some kind of reward for actually being in class. So maybe I'll just forget to put the session online. No? Or no, even better, what I'll do is I'll put it online, but after 5 minutes, it'll go blank for an hour and 10, and then come back again for the last five. Leave them guessing what happened in the middle. Hey, I'll figure some punishment. Actually, it's not punishment. I mean, people have to go. They have to go. Anyway, let's pick up where we left off. There are, I think, about 25 quizzes in my office still. I don't want them. I have never wanted them. I don't want them in the future. So if you don't want them, that's fine. But I'm not going to keep. I have to, I think, legally keep this for like a year. But I'll put it in some place where I can't even find it in about a week. So if you want the quizzes, come and get them soon. Okay? So if you remember, this is the page I left you with last Wednesday. Monday, Wednesday, whatever day it was. Well, remember I described the Rio Disney. We worked through the numbers. We came out an accounting return of 4.11%. And then we said, hey, what do we compare this to? And we decided not to the risk-free rate. Why? Why not to the risk-free rate? Come on. It's not risk-free, so why would I compare to the risk-free rate? It's not a guaranteed investment. Not to the cost of equity. That's a tougher one. Why? It's not to the equity investors. In fact, what would I have needed to do to make this to the equity investors? On that previous page where I showed you the return on that I computed of 4.11%, if I wanted to make it to equity investors, first I'd have to subtract out interest expenses. Remember, I didn't do it. I'd come up with a net income. And instead of dividing by the total amount invested in the theme park, I'd have to divide by the equity invested in the theme park. It would be the return on equity. So not to the risk-free rate, not to the cost of equity, but to the cost of capital. And which cost of capital? Justin kind of answered the question, but theme park's cost of capital. This is what we've been leading up to, right? So in a sense, it all should come together. But there's one small problem. So let me lay out what the problem is. The theme park cost of capital is 6.61%, but that's the existing theme parks that Disney had in 2013. Tell me where they are in 2013. Orlando, Anaheim, Paris, Tokyo. Hong Kong hadn't opened yet. So these were all developed market theme parks. Where is this theme park going to be? It's going to be in Rio. So here's the question. Do you think a Rio investment for Disney is more risky than an investment in Orlando, Anaheim? Yes. Why? Tell me what the additional sources of risk are. Terrorism. There's no terrorists in Rio. Have you been in Rio? The whole city, it feels like you're in danger. But it's not terrorism that you're afraid of. So Zika virus? No, that wasn't there in 2013. We can't make up stuff in hindsight. Eh? What are the two things that you worry about when you're a U.S. company investing outside? What are the two additional sources of risk? One is currency risk, but that currency risk exists when I invest in Paris and Tokyo. So there's exchange rate risk. What else? The fact that you're in a risky market, a risky economy. Not so much terrorist risk, but the economy, if any of you have been tracking Brazil the last couple of years, when we talk about country risk, you can see it kind of unfold in front of you, right? There's a threat now that the president might have to step down. People are getting arrested all over the place. The economy is coming. It's actually imploding, right? The real economy declined by 4% last year, which is a huge drop. So here are the two risks. And the question I'm going to ask you is whether we should be adjusting for those risks. In other words, should I be adding something on to the 6.61% to reflect that risk? I think so, right? So let's break the two risks down. And you look at investing anywhere outside your domestic market, you're always going to have exchange rate risk. It's called currency risk. If you're Disney, my advice to them is don't worry about currency risk. That sounds like a weird thing to say, but here's why. What's the type of risk we build into our discount rates? Go back to the original basis from which we built up. It's risk that you cannot diversify away, right? Not you as a company, but your investors. Now do you see why, if it's exchange rate risk, I don't want them to worry? If you look at the top 17 investors in Disney, you're going to see BlackRock and State Street and Fidelity, which happen to be invested not just in U.S. stocks, but in stocks all over the world. When the dollar strengthens, what happens to those stocks? Some stocks go up, others go down. Exchange rate risk is the least of my worries as a foreign company. So if this investment were in Paris, I'd say use the 6.61% in U.S. dollar terms. You might have to replace with it, but I wouldn't add any country risk issue there because exchange rate risk doesn't bother me. The other type of risk is political risk. Political risk scares me. It scares me because I can't protect myself easily against it. I'll give you a very simple example of political risk. This is the fourth edition of the book. In the first two editions of this book, this project was not in Rio. It was in Bangkok, Thailand. Why did I move it? Because Disney very inconveniently opened the theme park in Hong Kong. I don't know why they didn't ask me about this. But the minute they opened, it didn't make sense for me to have a Bangkok theme park and a Hong Kong. So I had to move continents. Now, they're going to come and screw me up and open something in Sao Paulo. I'll have to move to Africa. If they come to Africa, God help me. Antarctica, Greenland, no. But Thailand actually gave me an extremely easy way of explaining what political risk was. In 2007, I think, the Thai Prime Minister came. You know how the UN meetings in New York? The way we know is traffic becomes a nightmare. They shut off entire blocks of that area. These UN meetings, and the Thai Prime Minister comes to the UN meetings. And while he was here at the meetings, there was a coup in Thailand, and he couldn't go back. So let me pose a riddle for you. If the prime minister of a country leaves the country and is unable to go back to the country, would you as a company investing in that country worry about being able to take your cash flows out of the country? The answer is obviously. That's political risk. So somehow I've got to bring that into my cost of capital. So how am I going to do that? So clearly I've got to add something to my 6.61%. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. We've created the architecture. How do we deal with country risk when we talked about we brought it in through the country risk premium, right? So here's all I did. I decided to go back to my original calculation. My risk-free rate is still the U.S. dollar risk-free rate because I'm doing everything in U.S. dollars, so that doesn't change. My beta is still the beta for theme parks. That's not changing. But in my equity risk premium, instead of using the equity risk premium for Disney as a company, I use the equity risk premium for Brazil. See how convenient this device is? So if I come to you with a project, now all you have to do is where I'm going to put the project. You put the equity risk premium for the project. Your cost of equity now is going to be much higher than would have been if I'd used my U.S. equity risk premium. That higher cost of equity pushes up my cost of capital to 8.5%. So instead of using a 6.61% cost of capital, I'm going to use almost an 8.5% cost of capital. And the difference is because this is a theme park in Rio. So what if I told you this was Moscow Disney? Bad idea, but let's say it was Moscow Disney. What would I do differently? I'd use the equity risk premium for Russia. In fact, one point you might take issue with me on this, and I should have thought through this more carefully, is it's true the theme park is in Brazil. But when you build a theme park in Brazil as Disney, do you expect to get all your people who come to the theme park come just from Brazil? Why do you have a theme park in Latin America? Because you want to pull people from Argentina, from Venezuela. So what might have actually made more sense here is rather than just say it's a Brazilian investment is to look at the composition of where they thought they were going to get their tourists. So 60% from Brazil, 20% from Argentina, 10% from Chile, 5%, and take a weighted average. You're saying, am I allowed to do that? You're allowed to do pretty much anything you want, if it makes sense. So that's my cost of capital for this theme park. You ready now? What is the return I showed you for this theme park? 4.11%, right? What do we say we need to make on this theme park? Roughly 8.5%. You ready? You're going to put an X and say, don't take the theme park? Doesn't look like it measures up, right? But before you make the decision, I'm going to add one more thing I might want you to think about. If you remember, when I did my 4.11% return on capital, I went out over the next 10 years. But I stopped in year 10. Why did I stop in year 10? Why not year 9, year 11, year 15? You know, I'm not alone. Half of all project analyses in the U.S. use a 10-year life. What's so magical about 10? Projects just fall apart in year 11? It's what everyone, and further, I think there's actually a logical reason here. I think 10 is what goes comfortably going landscape in Excel in one page. Sounds like an incredibly stupid reason, right? But you know how infuriating it is when one column keeps popping out page after page after page. There's really no good reason. We just stop after 10. You think, so what? I've got to stop somewhere. You notice a pattern in my return on capital as I go through time? It starts negative. Then as I go to year 4, year 5, year 6, look at the last columns. See it climbing? See where I'm going next? If I'd gone to year 15 instead of year 10, what would have happened to my average return? Probably have gone up year 20. You think that's always going to be true. What's so special about this project? Is this the first time Disney's built a theme park? Not really, right? How old is Disneyland? I remember seeing its 50th anniversary commercial running for like 7 years. I think it's finally 60 years old now. It opened in 1956, 60 years old. It makes more money for Disney now than it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, and definitely a lot more money than in the first 10 years. Yeah. Doesn't matter. That's irrelevant, right? Basically, as long as you don't expect rates to change. If I did it, as, you know, so if I renewed it after 10 years. So that's kind of a side issue. I could have used a 30-year rate and still stopped after 10 years. No, because the terminal year, basically each year, what are you doing? You're keeping the cost of capital fixed. It's not the same risk-free rate. It's actually a rolled-over cost of capital. So by the time I get to year 10, it's actually a new 10-year rate. I'm just assuming that I don't know which direction rates will go and that the 10-year rate stays constant over time. So that's never the reason we stop at 10. The reason we use 10-year rates is that's the most commonly used auction government bond is 10-year bonds. They're easy to get rates on. No, that's got nothing to do with the T-bond rate because, again, it's a rolled-over cost. So each year, it's almost like I'm renewing this cost of capital. It's not the first 10-year bond expiring at the end of the year 10. It's actually a new 10-year bond rolled over each year. Right? Consistency is the worst reason for doing things. There's no reason they don't have to match. Basically, return on capital is an annualized number. You're just assuming you can maintain that number. It's changing over time, but in a sense, there's no reason any of this stuff has to match up once you've got the comparisons going. So the reality is Disneyland is 60 years old. It makes a lot more money now. Disney World is 46 years old. I know all these trivia things about Disney now. And it makes more money for Disney now than it did 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. Euro Disney. Most of you are too young to remember, but in the first 10 years of Euro Disney, there are all these horror stories about how horrible this investment was. And most of them were written by people who have no idea what they were talking about. Because Euro Disney in its first 10 years actually did better than Disney World in its first 10 and Disneyland in its first 10. It lost money. But you know why it lost money? Because it was a big infrastructure investment. No infrastructure investment makes money right off the top. So you see where I'm going? I've killed this investment just when it's turning the corner, just when it's getting ready to start delivering cash flows to me. So for the moment, there's not much I can do about that, but what I'm saying is that before you reject this project, keep that thought in mind, that this might be too short a time frame to make the judgment. This is a really long infrastructure investment. So what's this decision that I'm asking you to based on? Return on capital, right? What are returns on capital based on? Earnings or cash flows? Returns on capital are based on... You want me to show you the table? What did I use? It's operating income divided by invested capital. Two accounting numbers. So first, it's not a cash flow return. It's an accounting return. Is it time-weighted? No, I just averaged everything out. It's not time-weighted, it's not earnings, it's not cash flow, it's not incremental. In fact, it violates every single rule we said we need in a good measure of return. You're saying, why do we waste so much time on it then? Because half of all project choices around the world are still based upon accounting returns. They're a terrible way to think about projects, but that's the way a lot of companies tend to think about projects. Any questions? Not so much first 20 years. They will not make enough money. This project starts to make money in year four. It just won't make enough money given what you've invested. The returns will be low. So it's not money losing. It's just not looking good, okay. Right?
So if I'm an investor, why would I want to wait 20 years?
Because a company is a collection of projects, right? A collection of projects. So if I have 10 toll roads, they're not all being built at the same time. Presumably my oldest toll roads are now in my cash cow days, so I collect cash flows from them. So if you invest in Disney, you're not investing in Rio Disney, you're investing in Disney as a company, where Disney World is your cash cow, but this is going to be the investment you make to create your future cash cows. So if you're investing in a company, you're investing in a collection of projects, not one project. And those projects are all of different ages. So the cash-rich projects from the past give you the cash flows today. But if you don't make these infrastructure investments today, you will not get any cash flows in the next 20 years from now. So you got to sow the seeds for future growth while you're collecting the harvest from... That's the essence of running a business, right? If you just say, look, I'm going to collect the cash flows and I'm going to go home, you're going to liquidate the business. Okay? So to the extent that you want this process to continue, you've got to renew yourself.
So let's imagine I'm 60 or 70 years old and I will be thinking of taking this investment as a marginal investment. As a
you'll still get cash flows. You're going to get your dividends from the old investments. No, but wait, you don't have to wait for this project to pay off for the stock price to go up, right? Do you get the point? Which is, if I take a good toll road investment today, does the market know it's a good toll road investment? Yeah, let's say it does. It knows that I have to wait 25 years, but the price will not wait 25. Do you see where I'm going next? Is the minute you make this investment, now look at your stock price will reflect expectations for what's going to happen. So if you want to collect your money tomorrow, what should you do? Sell the stock. You don't have to wait. You're not collecting the cash flow from the investment. You're collecting the stock price change that you got. So if you invested in Square 2 months ago, you know what I'm talking about, right? Square, the payment company. You'd have got it for 9.5. It's a company that's not going to make earnings or cash flows in the near future, maybe not even in the far future. You know what the stock price is today? $12. You'd have made about a 40% return. The projects haven't paid off. What's changed is people's expectations about the potential of the projects have changed. So all I'm saying is if you're 60, you don't have to wait for these projects to pay off. You just need people to be building in those expectations into the price today. And that's why we spent that time talking about our market short-term or long-term. Does the price reflect it? Because that's what drives whether you get rewarded or not. Not whether the cash flows in the project show up, but what kind of expectations get built into the price. Make sense to you? So you could invest in a single infrastructure project. Wait, you know the cash flows won't come for 25 years, but still be able to collect your money if people's perceptions of that project improve. So you build a toll road in the middle of India. Okay? If people's perceptions that this is going to be a good investment changes tomorrow, you'll be able to collect your spoils tomorrow. You don't have to wait for the cash flows to come in. That's right. That's what a market is. What do you think a market is? Every time you buy a stock, what do you think you're doing? You're making a bet on changing realities. Because everything is in the future. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Perceptions of that future change, and that's how you make money in investing, is by going into stocks where you think the perceptions are going to improve. This morning, for instance, Chipotle stock price is down 4%. You know why? In fact, somebody this morning, a new story came out that one employee at a Boston Chipotle has a norovirus. One employee. They lost about $3.5 billion in value. You think one guy was worth that much? No, it wasn't the one guy that was worth so much, but the perception was, if this is a problem and it spreads, that means Chipotle's growth is going to be at risk. So that's how markets work. They have to take information and make their best judgments of the future. Sometimes those perceptions improve. Sometimes they get worse. And the question of whether you make money depends on whether you pick those stocks where perceptions improve, as opposed to stocks where perceptions drop off. It's an expectations game. So now let's extend this concept. So if the return on capital, it's an accounting number, it's a crappy number, but it has become, in fact, in corporate finance, one of the most widely used numbers in corporate finance. Consultants use it, companies use it, to measure the quality of a company's investments. I'm going to take you back to the very first class. Remember I showed you a financial balance sheet? And I said, on a financial balance sheet for a company, there are assets in place and growth assets. Assets in place are investments you've already made, and growth assets are investments I expect you to make. So when I invest in a Chipotle, I'm investing both in the stores they've already opened and my expectations that they can keep opening more stores in the future. But it's based on expectations. Let's assume that you're looking at your company. You've picked your company, and so we'll go. I'll dispense with the nagging. You picked a company. And one of the first questions you need to ask when you look at your company, before you get ambitious about growth investments, is how good are my existing investments? Right? So when I look at Disney, I'm saying, are Disney's existing investments good? Now, if I threw that question to you, you would say, well, I've heard stories, you know, that Disney World does well, they've made a lot of money on Star Wars, but that's not going to get us anywhere because these are individual stories. So here's one number that you could use to make that judgment on whether Disney's existing investments are good investments. Take all of their projects put together today and look at the operating income that those projects deliver. That's what you're going to see as the operating income for the company. That comes from everything Disney does today, right? So that's your operating income. Then take all the money invested in these projects today, like what Disney World, Disneyland, and you're going to run into a problem because they invested in Disneyland in 1954 and 55, in Disney World in 1966, 67, 68. It's going to be tough for you to go back in time and find out what they invested, so you're going to cheat. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to look at the book value of what they have invested in those assets. It's book value, it's accounting, a lot of crappy stuff can happen. And you're going to add up the book value of debt and the book value of equity. So if you think of an accounting balance sheet, I'm adding up the book value of debt and equity. And because cash can't produce any operating income, you're going to net it out. That's called the invested capital in the company. So let's take Disney. In 2013, Disney made $6.92 billion in after-tax operating income. They made a lot of money. Their invested capital that year, book value of debt plus equity minus cash, was about $55 billion. So they invested $55 billion in existing projects and made $6.92 billion. You divide the $6.92 billion by $55 billion, you come with a return on capital for the entire company of 12.61%. I'll come back and deal with all the issues I have with this number. It's an accounting number. I'm trusting accountants on both the numerator and the denominator. I have a 12.61%. Is that a good return? What I'm going to do is I'm going to compare the 12.61% to the cost of capital that I got for Disney as a company, which is 7.81%. To the extent that I trust the accounting numbers, it looks like Disney is delivering 4.8% more than the cost of capital. Now, this is a purely mechanical calculation. My cost of capital came from the bottom-up approach. I've got a cost of capital. The return on capital comes from the accounting numbers. You're going to do this for your company, just like I have for not just Disney, but for my five companies. And once you get that number, I want you to ask a follow-up question. Why is this company earning more than its cost of capital? You see, it's because they make a lot of money. That's kind of going in circles. Why do they make a lot of money? They're taking on risk, but lots of people take on risk. So if all I have to do to beat the cost of capital is take on risk, we could all be rich, right? They're beating expectations, but again, we're talking about output, not input. Let me go back to Econ 101. Yes. They have good projects, but what gives them good projects? This is, you're saying this is getting to be too, it's like Deepak Chopra gone crazy kind of thing, right? Go in circles. You don't even know where you're going, down the sink or coming out of the sink, right? Remember in Econ 101, perfectly competitive product markets? I know you don't remember. Act like you do. If there's perfect competition, what happens? Every company earns its cost of capital. In a perfectly competitive world, you could never earn more than your cost of capital because the minute you do, what's going to happen? New competitors are going to come in and take out those excess returns. So when I tell you Disney makes more than its cost of capital, not only am I saying there is no perfect competition, I'm saying more, right? I'm saying Disney has some barrier to entry, some comparative advantage that allows them to earn more than the cost of capital, to get good projects, to earn those high returns. So what do you think Disney's comparative advantages? That's probably the least of their advantages. Licensing of what? Okay, now let's dig. So if I just license my face out, I'm not going to make excess returns. Don't dig too deep. How many years did it take to create the Mickey Mystic? 75 years, right? It's one of the most recognized characters on the face of the earth. So that's a competitive advantage. They own Star Wars, all those Star Wars characters. You've got Disney characters. Their competitive advantage comes from all those characters. And those characters got connected to you when you were, what, 3, 4, 5 years old. And now you live with those characters. So that's a competitive advantage. You see where I'm going? When you earn more than your cost of capital, that's what I mean by digging. What are my company's special advantages, competitive advantages? Because that then tells you why they can earn more than their cost of capital. And it also tells you what the threats are. So if I did Coca-Cola, Coca-Cola's return on capital is about 25%. Their cost of capital is about 9%. They earn well above their cost of capital. What's Coca-Cola's competitive advantage? I'm glad people said brand, not syrup. Because nobody cares about the taste, right? It's brand name. Okay, so that establishes what's the biggest threat that Coca-Cola faces to its brand name. What is the brand name selling? Happiness in Coca-Cola's mind, but a lot of sugar in a crappy little water bottle, which will kill you sooner rather than later. That's their problem. The product is, in fact, potentially deadly. Which means that you worry about health pushes that, I mean, there are lots of school systems around the country already that are banning sodas because of the sugar. So if you're Coca-Cola, you're saying, I have a brand name, I'm earning more than the cost of capital, but I see threats coming, and I need to do something about it. I don't know whether you can create a healthy version of a cola, but if you could, you're working on something like that. So not only do you need to identify what your competitive advantages are, you're also asking the follow-up question. What are the threats that I see to that competitive advantage? So as I go down this list, Disney earned 4.8% more than its cost of capital. Vale earned 2.22% more than its cost of capital. Okay. What's Vale's competitive advantage? Yeah, they have all these iron ore reserves, especially in Brazil that they started off with. How did they get those reserves? They used to be a government company. The government just gave them those reserves. You see where I'm going? Sometimes we think of competitive advantages coming from great managers. Sometimes you're just given Aramco. Their stock of it going public, right? If it goes public, it could be the most valuable company on the face of the earth. $2 trillion is what they're estimating. You know what Aramco is, right? It's a Saudi Arabian oil company. Of course, right now it's a privately owned enterprise. What's Aramco's competitive advantage? You stick your finger in the sand in Saudi Arabia, oil comes out. Cost them almost nothing to get the oil out. It's an incredible advantage to have over a Canadian oil company that has to go 5,000 feet under the ground, get frozen oil out, unfreeze it, and try to sell it. It'll cost them $55. But that competitive advantage came to Aramco. Why? Because the Saudi family essentially said, you're Aramco, you're our company, here you can have the reserves. They were endowed with those reserves. That's a competitive advantage. So all I'm saying is don't assume that just because a company has a competitive advantage, somehow the existing managers need to be rewarded. Coca-Cola's existing managers did nothing, zero, to create this competitive advantage. Doesn't mean they're useless, because they still have to defend that competitive advantage. But we have to be careful about going around saying, you're a great manager, you have a competitive advantage. If you look at Baidu, 17.63% higher than the cost of capital. What's that competitive advantage? Well, you don't let me use Google in China. So this is the Chinese government dispensing, you can have a competitive advantage. Tata Motors, competitive advantage, excess returns of 9.55%. Remember what we said when I did the Jensen's Alpha? Where did I say all of Tata Motors' money has come from or returns have come from for the last 5 years? Jaguar Land Rover. At this point, almost all of those excess returns you see at Tata Motors are coming from the Jaguar Land Rover part, not from the Tata Motors part. And finally, Bookscape is barely breaking even. That's not good news. Why? Because that means you're going to have one less bookstore sooner rather than later. This is, as I said, one of the most widely used numbers now in corporate finances, return on invested capital. It scares me how people use it, because they read all kinds of meanings into it. So I'm going to give you some suggestions here. The first is, people have used these excess returns in lots of ways, and consulting firms especially love this number. So about 25 years ago, this consulting firm called Stern Stewart, which started in New York, decided that they were going to come up with their own version of this excess return number. So what they did was they took the spread I computed on the previous page, return on capital minus the cost of capital, and multiplied it by the book value of capital invested in each of these companies. See, what the hell is that going to do? It converts your excess returns into a dollar value. They called it economic value added, or EVA. And if you see EVA ever mentioned in public, there'll always be a little R with a circle around it, which means what? That they've trademarked the number. They said, this is the newest, greatest way of thinking about projects. Don't use the old return on capital minus cost of capital. Use EVA. Take a look at the EVA. For an EVA to be positive, what has to be true? You got to earn more than the cost of capital. So they're telling you, you have to earn more than the cost of capital. What insight? I never thought about that until they showed me the EVA. And they said, if you can earn a big excess return on a lot more money than less money, that's good. Okay, that's great. So if I earn a 7% excess return on $7 billion, that's better than $1 billion. I never knew this until you told me. But the amazing thing was, during the 1990s, this became the hottest concept among consulting. Stern Stewart, at one point in time, was being used by half of the S&P 500 companies, half of the 500 largest market cap companies, because CEOs loved EVA. It's a testimonial to how in finance we package the obvious, we claim the outrageous, and we charge the absurd. That's what consultants do. Take the obvious, package it, claim that it can do all kinds of wondrous things, and then charge you absurd amounts of money for using it. It's human nature, I guess. So I've been looking at this number for a long time now, and which number? This return invested capital number. And I'll tell you, I am a little bit of a skeptic on what this number actually measures. But these were the return spreads that I computed for for global companies in 2014. So basically what I did was I took every, at the start of every year, I take every company, and I have 41,000 companies in my data set, every publicly traded company. I compute the return on capital for every company and the cost of capital for every company. Sounds like a lot of work, but I just automate it. Then I compare the return on capital to the cost of capital. And we said that if you earn more than the cost of capital, then you're doing a good job, right? In 2014, about 55% of all companies earned well below their cost of capital. That's more than half of all publicly traded companies out there earned less than the cost of capital. That's a scary number. Most companies out there earn well below their cost of capital. You can dig and see why that might be. But that is basically a number that you see used all the time, and now you get some insight into where that number comes from. It's, you know, basically it's comparing the return capital to the cost of capital. Any questions on what we're trying to measure with this and what the limitations are? So now let me return to the project. So I'm going to, that was a tangent on using return on capital. So far I've shown you the return on capital on this project. Now let's talk about how I can go back to the project and come up with a better way of judging that project. I said return on capital is an accounting earnings number. We want a cash flow number. So the first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to go from earnings to cash flows. So let me lay out the process. Remember the three adjustments I talked about to get from earnings to cash flows. I'm going to add back depreciation and amortization. I'm going to subtract out CapEx. I'm going to subtract out the change in working capital. I get the cash flow. Let me take that one piece at a time. I'm adding back depreciation and amortization because it's an accounting expense that I subtracted out, but it's not a cash expense. I'm subtracting out capital expenditures because even though the accountant said don't worry about it, I've got to pay for it. And I'm subtracting out the change in working capital because I want to go from accrual earnings to cash earnings. So now take a look at the bottom line numbers. Now notice in year 0, 1, and 2 are big negative numbers. What is that capturing? Why do I have big negative cash flows up front? I'm building the theme park. In fact, when you looked at the accounting numbers, that should have made you a little suspicious that everything looks so good in year 1 and 2. It looked good because the accountant was smoothing things out, but from a cash flow perspective, I'm spending a ton of money up front, so I have negative cash flows. Those negative cash flows continue till year 3. Finally, in year 4, you see a glimmer of hope. The cash flow turns positive, and then it starts to climb as the product. That's the nature of infrastructure investments. Negative cash flows up front, turning to positive cash flows, the cash flows will get more positive over time. Now, I'm going to take this calculation apart because each of these adjustments has embedded in it some cash flow effects that I want to focus on. Let's start with depreciation and amortization. Here's what I did. I subtracted our depreciation and amortization to get to operating income. Then I'm adding it back to get to cash flow, right? Doesn't that seem like a waste? Why subtract it and then add it back? Why not just ignore it? In fact, a lot of analysts I see use what's called EBITDA because they say, well, why subtract out the DA and then add back the DA? It seems like a waste of time. It's not, and here's why. When I subtract out the depreciation and amortization and add it back, it leaves an imprint on my cash flows because what's the advantage of depreciation and amortization? It's tax deductible. So what it effectively does is each year it increases my cash flow by the amount of tax benefit I get from that depreciation. It's actually very easy to compute the tax effect of depreciation. You got the depreciation each year. Your tax rate was, I think, 36.1%. So in year one, when I have $50 million in depreciation, I'm saving $18 million in taxes. That's why we need to subtract our depreciation and add it back, because our cash flows are going to be higher with the depreciation than without. You had a question. I kind of skipped entirely over the question. You've forgotten the question. Let's go.
It was whether you can think of
land
value in terms of
it's a pricing effect, you know. So it's not just gross pricing margin, but it's one of the places it's going to show up. It's going to have a much higher margin when you have a strong brand name. No, because the margins can be high and you can have a horrible return on capital. Your margins can be low and you can have a high return. Walmart for a long time had a high return on capital. Really low margins. So it's only a piece of the puzzle. Lots of other pieces have to go away. So let's talk about this tax benefit from depreciation. So by subtracting and adding back depreciation, I get a tax benefit. That tax benefit works only if you have if you're paying taxes. Right? So if you're a hospital or a nonprofit, subtracting and adding it back is going to do nothing for you. The higher your tax rate becomes, the greater the tax benefit will be to getting depreciation. I kind of mentioned this last class, but during the 1970s, the leasing business in the U.S. kind of exploded, became a really big business. And here's one reason. You know what the highest marginal tax rate for individuals was in the 1970s in the U.S.? It was 70%. Okay? So let's say you guys are individuals, very wealthy individuals, and you're paying a 70% tax rate. The highest marginal tax rate for companies was about 35%. So let's assume you're an airline. You buy aircraft, you depreciate the aircraft. Big depreciation, right? What's the tax benefit you're getting right now as a company? 35% of the depreciation. Can you devise a way in which I might be able to take advantage of their 70% tax rates? Ultimately, all you care about is you need aircraft to load your passengers and fly them around, right? Do you have to buy the aircraft? Now, what if those guys bought the aircraft? They get together as a group of very rich people. They buy the aircraft, and then they lease it to you. Now, let's think about what's going to happen. You guys have bought the aircraft. So when you get the depreciation of the aircraft, what's the tax benefit you get? You get a 70% tax depreciation. They're saying, what's in it for them? You might give them a little bit of those savings. So instead of having just the tax benefit of 35%, you might end up with a 45% tax saving, and they end up with a 25% tax saving. That's the essence of the leasing business, is when you have very different tax rates across an economy, the higher tax rate entities will buy the assets and lease them to the lower tax rate entities and take advantage of the tax difference. The leasing business almost died in 1986. What happened in 1986? First time in U.S. corporate history, the highest marginal tax rate for individuals became 28%, and the highest marginal tax rate for corporations was also 28%. See how the business disappears? Because the minute I do that, you no longer want to lease. So the essence of leasing is you're trying to take advantage of different tax rates. So that's the first thing to remember. If you're not paying taxes, you don't care about depreciation. If you pay taxes, depreciation leaves a cash flow imprint. Yeah?
Going back to depreciation.
Yeah.
So what does it take before adding it back in to get a cash flow of the firm? When did you take that out prior?
When we did the operating income? I subtracted it out to get to taxable income. So when I subtracted it out, my taxable income went down. When my taxable income went down, my taxes went down. So I subtracted it out to get to operating income, and now I'm adding it back. But because I paid less in taxes, I actually saved on taxes because of its existence. So it's kind of hidden in there. So if you wanted to back it out, that's what the effect of depreciation would be. Yes?
What do you mean when you say individuals have a 70% tax rate? Does it mean like me as in?
Don't worry, you no longer have this. This is the
1970s. Okay.
Yeah.
But does it mean that I can buy it if you do something and depreciate it on my tax return even if I don't have a business? Or?
Make that your business. The leasing business is a business. So start a leasing business. Right? There's nothing that stops you from starting a business as an individual.
Okay.
And all you do is you buy an aircraft and you lease them out.
But the 70% tax rate was for businesses, not
No, but the income flows through into your taxes, right? You run the business. It's not a corporation. It's a private business.
Okay.
So the income flows through to you. You get taxed at your individual tax rate.
Right.
Right? So I have a private business that I run on the side. The income from that business will show up in my 1040 as business income. I will get taxed at my marginal tax rate. So that's how the savings kicks in, is because the depreciation is in that business, you get the tax savings based on the business. If you started a corporation, then the business advantage goes away. That's why as the leasing entity, you have to be not a company. You have to be a person who pays the 70% tax rate. And that's how the 1970s lease business was born. Right? Now let's do a what if here. Right? I know whether in accounting you talked about different ways you can depreciate. The accountants usually have to fill time, so this is one of the ways they fill time, is they talk about different depreciation methods. I'm going to cut to the chase. Broadly speaking, the way you depreciate an asset can fall into one or two groups. You can use straight-line depreciation where you depreciate the same amount every year. Or you can have accelerated depreciation where you get more depreciation up front and less later. So collectively, you get the same depreciation in both cases. But in one case, you get the same amount every year. In the other case, you get more up front, less later. So ready? You've just bought this incredibly expensive equipment. $100 million investment. And I give you two choices. You can depreciate $10 million every year for the next 10 years, or you can get $22 million next year as depreciation, dropping off over time to give you a collective depreciation of $100 million. So let's start with first the effect that that choice will have on earnings. So let's say you're a company focused on earnings this year. Which depreciation method will give you higher earnings? Straight line depreciation or accelerated depreciation? I'm going to give you the chance again. For earnings, right? You subtract our depreciation to get to earnings. So would you rather be depreciating straight line or accelerated to get higher earnings? Straight line depreciation is less depreciation, so you'll get higher earnings, right? You see why? Subtracting $10 million rather than $22 million will give you higher earnings. Now let me ask you the interesting follow-up question. It'll also mean less taxes this year, but you'll still have after-tax income. It'll be much lower with $22 million in depreciation than $10 million, right? Nothing. Let's say before tax, your EBITDA is $30 million. The first case, 30 minus 10 will give you $20 million in pre-tax income and maybe $12 million after-tax income. In the second case, 30 minus 22 will give you $8 million, and after tax, you'll have only 4.8. Accounting earnings-wise, you will always be worse off using accelerated depreciation. But from a cash flow perspective, which one will give you the higher cash flows? You got a 50-50 shot? Accelerated depreciation will give you the higher cash flows. Why? Because you get a bigger tax benefit, and when I add back the depreciation, which is what I do to get to cash flows, the $22 million gets added back. I'll get much higher cash flows when I use accelerated depreciation. Let's say the market values your company based on cash flows. But analysts keep watching your earnings. So you want to keep both groups happy. Is there a way you can keep both groups happy? You see what my question is? You want to have the higher earnings that straight-line depreciation offers you, but you also want the higher cash flows that accelerated depreciation offers. You can have two sets of books. It's completely legal in the U.S. Most corporations have two sets of books. They have reporting books and they have tax books. In the tax books, they use accelerated depreciation. In the reporting books, they report straight-line depreciation. How many of you have pulled up the financial statements for your company, the 10-Ks, the annual reports? Act like you have this. Yeah. What do you think is going to be reported there? Tax depreciation or what they want you to see as depreciation? You're going to get that reported depreciation. So the tax books are going to give you a very different depreciation number. And you know how you can tell? You'll have things like deferred taxes in your balance sheet, which basically means the accountants are telling you, we're playing games with you. Look how big the game is. So that's the first thing. Depreciation saves you taxes. And if that's the case, you want to get as much depreciation as you can early on because the present value of the depreciation is much greater than waiting and getting it in your time. Comes right out of the depreciation tax benefit. Now let's talk about capital expenditures. Now the initial CapEx, you could see why I did it, right? Because I needed to kind of get the infrastructure project off the ground. But I also have a second item for CapEx that I call maintenance CapEx. I mentioned this yesterday. But maintenance CapEx is what you put into the project, not because you want it to grow, but because you want it to keep going. So let's talk about the Rio Disney theme park. If you walk through any Disney theme park, usually there's at least one or two rides closed down almost every single time you go, right? And what's happening usually there, either renovating the ride or replacing the ride. Why? Because, you know, otherwise you can't get people coming back. They're not going to come back if it's the same seven rides every single time. That's maintenance capex. It's a pretty big investment, but you have to do it, because if you don't do it, your theme park is going to look really crappy in about 7 years, and people are not going to go. So in my case, I've put money back into this theme park, not because I want to. It's cash draining from me, but I put it back because I want this theme park to continue. And the longer I want this theme park to keep going, the more I have to put into maintenance capex to be there. The way I like to think about it is depreciation is like burning off calories. Capital maintenance is like eating. So if all you do is burn off calories, burn off calories, burn off calories, in about 15 days, you're going to be close to dead. That's what happens to projects that don't put capital maintenance back, is the project is draining down. So you've got to put at least some. How much you put back will depend on how long you want this project to go, but that's the essence of maintenance capex. You know what? When you go into a mall, you can always tell which retailers set aside money for maintenance capex and which retailers do not. You know how you can tell? First day you walk in, it's a new mall, all the stores look new, right? You go back to that mall 3 years later, some of the stores still look new. And some look like they're 3 years old and nothing's been done to them. That comes from maintenance capex. Money doesn't magically grow on trees. You've got to plan for it. Maintenance capex is your way of saying, I want this store to keep delivering revenues and I'm going to put money back. Any questions on maintenance capex? So now let's look at this capex question. What happens when you have capital expenditures? You put it as an asset, then you depreciate it over time, right? Let's suppose that you made an investment and you have the option to either treat it as capital expenditures or expense it right away. I'll give you an example. Okay? Now, this in the late 1990s, one of the ways that AOL was growing was they'd put CDs into magazines. No, this is too, you know, you don't even, you picked up a magazine, you shook it, an AOL CD would fall out. You shook it two more times, three more CDs would fall out. At one point in time, half of all the expenses that AOL had as a company were expenses associated with sending out these CDs. You're saying, that is absurd. Because that's how they grew. Here's how it happened. If you by accident, one of my kids actually took one of those CDs and put it into my computer, it takes over your damn computer. It took me like 2 months to wipe out every vestige of AOL left, because it installed itself all over the place. It was like a virus gone crazy. But then they also got a lot of people who tried to say, okay, I'm on AOL. So half their expenses were these CDs. Now, these CDs are the way they grow, right? So technically, you could argue that it's really capex. You should be, you know, treating it as capex and depreciating it over time. But let's say you have the choice of either expensing it or treating it as a capex. Again, let me separate the two parts of the question. Which one is better for your earnings, to expense something or to capitalize and depreciate it? Think of what happens. When you expense it, you're going to take the entire $50-100 million today, which means your earnings are going to collapse right away. If you capex and depreciate it, you're going to spread it out over the next 10 years. So from an earnings perspective, it's always better to capex and spread it out over time. But from a cash flow perspective, if you have a choice, you want to expense it. Why? Because you get the tax benefit right away. So with both depreciation and capex, you can see how your choices can have very different effects on accounting earnings and cash flows, and why you might play two different games with two different audiences. To an audience that cares only about earnings, you're going to be saying, I have no capex, I have lots of capex, very little depreciation, straight line depreciation. For a group that cares about cash flows, you expense everything, you get the tax benefits right away, you show much higher cash flows. And finally, there is working capital. Remember, the working capital just makes accrual earnings into cash earnings. But let's dig a little deeper. Let's think about what it is we mean when we talk about working capital. So let's assume that you decide to start a business. How, let's make it a used car lot. You want to become a used car sales business. Horrible business, but let's say there's a lot of money to be made. Okay? So ready, what's the first thing you do? You go buy or lease some land off a highway. Why off a highway? Because it's probably cheaper. Then you hang up your no sign saying used car lot. But before you open the doors, what else do you have to buy to get this business off the ground? You need cars, right? You can't have an empty lot and ask people to come and say, tell me what car you want, I'll come back to you with it. So let's say you buy 100 cars. So let's keep them cheap. $1,000 a piece, these are used cars. So you have $100,000 you've invested in cars. So on day one, when I look at your balance sheet, you're going to show $100,000 as inventory, right? That you have to spend the money. First day you open the doors, 15 people come in, each of them buys a car. You're a great salesperson. Everybody walks in, buys a car. That's 15 out of the 100 cars are gone, right? But to get ready for business the next day, what do you have to do? You have to go buy 15 other cars. You can't let all the cars. So you see what I'm saying? So, and if your business, if 15 people came in, that might mean that you don't have enough cars. So to reflect the growth, you might need 105 cars tomorrow and 110. Each time you have to put money into this business, that's cash tied up. That's what working capital is. Basically, it's a cash you have tied up in inventory or when you grant credit to somebody that you will not be able to get until you do what? Until you shut the business down. At which point, you have a going out of business sale and you get all the cash flows back. But during the life of your business, that cash is tied up just as much as the cash you invest in land and building and equipment and machinery, because it's cash you cannot get to. If you start a business, you've got to plan for working capital needs. Otherwise, you're going to run into some really serious trouble with cash flows. Hey, I've been walking up and down Bleecover now for 31 years. No, I don't walk up and down Bleecover. So you kind of get what I mean. I'm not walking up and down, up and down, up and down. That'd be crazy. Right? But every time I walk down Bleecker, I check the storefronts. This is a street where nothing is permanent. Your business opens. 2 weeks later, you pass by, the business is gone. New business opens. There are like two places left that have been around for 31 years. I constantly wonder, why is there so much turnover in businesses? Many of them are retailers. I'm convinced that one reason is that they have big rent expenses they've got to cover. The other is, when you start a retail business, one of the easiest things it is to underestimate is how much working capital you need. Why? Because you run a retail business, you can think about the rent and the land and the building, but really your inventory, especially if you're an expensive retailer, can be a third or a half of the cash tied up in the business. And if you're growing, it actually means you need even more cash tied up in the business, which is part of the reason that success could be deadly for you. Because the faster you grow, the more cash you need to tie up. And the more cash you need to tie up, if you haven't planned for it, the more trouble you're in. So if you're starting a business, make sure you bring in working capital into your requirements, because if you don't, you're not going to be setting aside enough cash to cover that business. And if you can find a way to reduce your working capital needs, it's going to increase your cash flows. I remember what the Gap about 10 years ago decided to reduce the number of colors they carried from 9 to 7. Because they carry the same colors in T-shirts. And from 9 to, you're saying, what's the big deal? They just took the two colors that weren't being bought enough. Those two colors being taken out of the inventory created $200 million in cash flows for the Gap that year. That's two less items to carry in inventory. Have you ever gone to Trader Joe's? Okay. One of my favorite grocery stores. Grocery store, you can actually go in and come out without feeling like you wandered into Albania. It's small, it's compact. One of the things about a Trader Joe's is their inventory is only like 4 deep. And when they sell something out, that's it. No. They're willing to actually lose sales from not having stuff than have stacks and stacks and stacks of things that they will never sell. Saves them an incredible amount of money. In terms of saving. It's also the revolution that Walmart introduced into retailing. If you walk into a Walmart, you'll see a guy with that gun, not a real gun, no, sometimes a real gun, but this is the gun that you read all those barcodes, constantly walking. Now, I followed him one day just to see what he was doing. He thought I was creepy, you know, I just wanted to see what. And he's constantly tracking the inventory. Because for Walmart, this makes a huge difference. Because Walmart's objective is that they keep working capital requirements to as close to zero as they can. See, how can they do that? They need inventory. You know how they keep the working capital close to zero? What's working capital? It's inventory, accounts receivable, accounts payable, right? So what they do is they take their time to pay their suppliers And they keep the inventory low, and they essentially make the working capital into almost a zero item, which is a huge saving for a retailer. So when you think about working capital, that's why we care about working capital. So now I'm kind of ready to go to the next step. I've gone from earnings to cash flows by adding back depreciation, subtracting out CapEx, subtracting change in working capital. I now want to make these cash flows incremental cash flows. Sounds mysterious, but there are two items that I mentioned last class that I think I need to go back to. One of those items is I told you that Disney had $500 million that they'd already invested in this project, right? What else did I tell you about the $500 million? That they were not going to get it back if you decided to reject the project. In finance, what do we call that? That's a sunk cost. And what are we supposed to do with sunk costs? Ignore them. Why? Because it's already happened. I'll give you a very simple way in which you can try to answer this incremental question. Ask yourself two questions. What will happen if I take this project? What will happen if I don't take this project? If your answer is the same to both the questions, that item has no business in your analysis. So let me ask you that question about the $500 million. What will happen if I take the project? I've already spent the $500 million. What will happen if I don't take the project? I've already spent the $500 million. What difference does this project make? Absolutely nothing. So I'm going to take the $500 million out of my initial investment, saying I should never have counted that as part of my investment because that money is gone. Here's the other item. Remember that allocated G&A, that expense that the accountant attached to this project? I told you 2/3 of that G&A was going to be there anyway. What am I talking about? I'm talking about Bob Iger's bonus. He's not going to take a smaller bonus if you don't take this project. It's just going to move to somewhere else. So let's ask the question, what will happen if I take this project? Well, that 2/3 is going to show up in this project. What will happen if I don't take the project? That 2/3 is going to show up somewhere else. It's still going to be there. It is not incremental. So what I did was I added back that allocated G&A that I should not have subtracted out to say, look, that's not incremental. It's one of the trickiest things in finance is figuring out this incremental concept. I'll tell you a story that I think brings this home better than any example I could give you. It's about 10 years ago. I used to do all these investment banking training programs that increasingly I've shed each year that I do this because I find it, you know, an incredible grind. But I used to, at one point in time, starting on July 5th, go all the way through July 30th, teaching almost every single day at a different investment bank. At some point, you know, especially as I got later and later in the month, I'd have no idea who I was talking to or what I was talking about, but I was an autopilot. I could basically spend 3 days on corporate finance and get out of there. So this was towards the end of July. I was ready to get out of there. I had a Hawaii trip planned, I think. I was already mentally away in Kauai. Right? And it was in an uptown hotel. I think it might have been Bank of America Merrill Lynch. I think it was one of those big hotels there. Huge ballroom. There are like 450 analysts. So it's the night. I start talking. I really don't want to be there. They don't want to be there. You know, so nobody's really paying any deep attention, except for that one guy at the door who was doing the catering outside. He was setting up the food and the stuff. He was the most attentive person in the whole room, and that included me. So the end of the second day, after I talked about this concept, he comes up to me and he says, "I've been listening to you, so I'm glad somebody is." And he said, "I know you were talking about something today. I have a question for you." I said, "Okay, somebody has a question." He said, "I'm from Guatemala. And every year when I fly back home, I go to the Gap and the Limited and I buy seconds. Seconds are clothes with little damage on them." He says, I spend about $600 buying these seconds. I fly to Guatemala and I sell these clothes for $1,000. But it cost me about $750 to fly round trip to Guatemala. And all my accountant friends tell me I should stop doing this." You can see how the accountant mind works, right? You buy for $600, you sell for $1,000. That's $400 in profits. How much does it cost to fly? $750 minus $350. Don't do it. But before you say don't do it, what's the question you need to ask this guy? "Are you going to fly to Guatemala anyway?" And he said, "My entire family's there. Of course I'm going to do it." So if he listens to his accountant friends and stops buying this stuff next time, what's going to happen next year? He's going to fly to Guatemala. It's going to cost him $750. He will not have the offsetting $400 he had this year. He's going to spend $750 instead of $350. This is why you shouldn't listen to your accountant friends. Why? Because that 750 is not incremental. You're going to do it anyway. It has nothing to do with this investment you've latched it onto. That is the essence of incremental, is you're saying, if this is going to happen anyway, why am I rejecting this investment to get this back? I've seen companies do really stupid things because they've ignored this concept. There's an investment bank, I will leave unnamed, that in the late 90s decided to shut down Asian equities. Asia had serious crises in 97, 98. They shut down Asian equities. Why? Because they were showing a loss. At that time, the investment bank ran all of its Asian equities out of New York. So I said, how come you're showing such a loss? I took a look at the numbers, and it turns out that they were showing a loss because people were allocating everything but the kitchen sink to Asian equities. Things like, you went out for a Chinese dinner, you said, that's Asian, charge it to Asian equities. I mean, any reason you could. Asian equities basically became the repository. So you shut down Asian equities. Are you guys going to stop going for Chinese dinners? You're still going to do it. You're going to charge it to structured products or unstructured products or something else. This expense is not going to go away just because you shut down Asian equities. So when we talk about sunk costs, that's what we're talking about, is taking out those, you know, taking out those costs that are going to be there anyway. Okay. Having said that, though, there's a lot of findings in behavioral finance that tell you that this is one of the most difficult things to do, is to ignore sunk costs. I'll give you a very simple example. Let's say you decide to stand in line for a bank teller. Does anybody do that anymore? Let's say you're one of those people who decides to get that experience of stand. So, and you think it's going to take you only 10 minutes. So you say, what's the big deal? I'm going to stand in line. 35 minutes later, you're still standing in line. The line hasn't moved. Maybe it's moved a little bit. What should you do? You should think incrementally. So it's going to take less than 10 minutes from this point on. But you also think about the fact that you've already spent 35 minutes standing in line. So you know what you're going to do? Because you've already spent 35 minutes, you're going to stand in line even more. It's the same reason when you go into a casino and you lose $200. What's your rational side say? Leave. Leave right now. Leave really quickly. And then you hear this voice in the back of your head, I'll leave as soon as I get my $200 back. That's a sunk cost. Talking to you, say, as long as, once I make myself whole, how do you think traders end up losing $6 billion? I mean, how do you lose $6 billion? Right? You don't start off saying, I'm going to lose $6 billion over the next 6 months. You probably lost $20 million on that first day. You try to make it back the second day, ended up losing $50 million. You try to get back the $50 million, becomes $200 million. We violate the sunk cost rule all of the time. It's called the Concord fallacy in behavioral finance, which is people, once they know they've already invested in something, have a very difficult time separating themselves from having made that investment. They feel this urge to throw good money after bad because they've already spent so much money. So I can tell you what you should do, but I'll also guarantee that once you get out there and you start a business and you start making decisions, intellectually you know you've got to ignore the sunk costs, but emotionally you're going to find it really, really difficult to do. How many? Now I won't ask you who did badly on quiz one, but you know if you did badly on quiz one, right? So think about it. Don't think too long. Now here's what I want you to do. It's a sunk cost. It is a sunk cost, and you got to let it go. It's easier said than done, because it's going to eat away. When you sit down for the second quiz, the fact that you did badly on the first quiz, that's that behavioral issue, is separating yourself from that, the fact that you've already done something you wish you hadn't. So let's do one final iteration of the sunk cost. If you think about how pharmaceutical companies work, you do R&D, right? When you do R&D, you don't know whether you're going to get a product or not. So by the time you get to the point of making the decision on the product, you've already spent $3 billion, $5 billion, $7 billion, $9 billion, $11 billion. If you're a consumer product company, you do test marketing. Why do you do test marketing? You're doing test marketing to see if there's a market. By the time you've spent the money, it's already a sunk cost. So let's do an example. Let's assume you're a consumer product company. You've already spent $100 million doing the test marketing for a product. You've collected the information, and based on the information, you think you can make $25 million from this point on. So to create value from this point, I'm only $25 million. Would you take this project? Yeah, from this point on. But collectively, what happened on this project? You spent $100 million to get to this decision to add only $25 million. Let's assume that on product after product after product, this happens. What happens? You spend $100 million, then you get to the decision, and there's $25 million. You won't last in business very long, right? And that's, I think, one of the quandaries. If you're a pharmaceutical company or a consumer product company, you want to make sure you can cover those test marketing costs, those R&D costs with your successful products, which means that you can't let them become sunk before you start asking questions. And that's the big difference between pharmaceutical companies in the 1980s and today. In the 1980s, if you're a pharmaceutical company in the U.S., you wrote a check out to R&D. Now spend $3 billion. And then you worried about making the money back because you had pricing power, you made the money back. Today, before you start research on a new drug, you will be asked, well, how do we know this is going to be a good drug? And that's, you know how difficult it is, right? You don't have the information. R&D people hate it. But you can see why that question needs to be asked before the money gets spent. Because once you spend the money, it becomes a sunk cost. And once it becomes a sunk cost, you can't get it back. Finally, allocated costs. That allocated G&A that I gave you, accountants decide how much to allocate, right? And accountants, based on all kinds of things, how much revenue you have, how many people you employ, they have all these little criteria. But the essence of allocated cost, though, is most of those costs have nothing to do with you. They're just being allocated to you, just like the Chinese equity cost. It's being allocated to you. It's not fair. And when you make decisions, you want to base it on incremental costs. So let's assume I told you what the allocated cost was, and you're trying to figure out how much of this is incremental. Let's see if you can figure out a way to come up with how much of an allocated G&A cost is incremental. I'm going to show you a company where I'm going to show you G&A costs over time. So there's the G&A cost, 250, 270, 300. I'm going to show you revenues over time. I want you to tell me, based on just those 3 years, assume that that's the data you have, how much of those G&A costs are fixed and how much are variable. So let's take the third year's cost, $300 million. So how much of those costs are fixed? How much are variable? Is there a way you could do it? Yeah. $250 is fixed. Tell me how you reasoned your way to it.
So the difference between year one and year two is $200 in revenue
and $20 in G&A. Okay, so each dollar in revenue creates 10 cents in G&A cost, right? So I'm going to let you redo the example. So if you have 1,500 in revenues, how much of that cost is variable? How much is fixed?
So the difference between year 3 and year 1 is $500 in revenues and $50 in G&A cost. It's for $1 of revenues.
Yeah, but that's only a portion of the variable cost, right? So if you want to say what the total variable cost is, what do you have to do? You have to make the revenues zero, right? If the revenues become zero, what do my G&A costs become? Just look at the, I mean, I tried to make it so that you could work it in your head. It's going to $150. So $150 million is going to be fixed. Do you see why it's $150 million fixed? That's the easiest way to answer the G&A cost is make your revenues go to zero. It's a complete hypothetical because if it goes to zero, your company is sunk. But if it goes to zero, what would my G&A cost be? That becomes fixed and the rest becomes variable. It's a quick and dirty way. It worked here because I set up the numbers to work nicely for the regular company. It's going to be a lot messier. But that's something I want you to think about when you think about allocated costs is essentially that notion of fixed and variable costs. I know you guys are lagging here. You're going to wait. This is your how many of you is this the last class before spring break? Okay, so 3 more minutes, and then you can take off. Okay. Last step in the process, I want to time weight these incremental cash flows. What is time weighting? Time weighting is just discounting. That's all the time weighting is. So when we talk about discounting a cash flow, we're really talking about time weighting a cash flow. This is no longer the case, but in the old finance textbooks, there used to be a present value table at the end of the book. Some newer books might still have it. If you ever see a present value table, here's what it'll read like. A dollar in 1 year is worth 91 cents. So basically, you can read down, and a dollar in 3 years is worth 72 cents. A dollar in 4 years is worth 63 cents. That's really a time waiting, right? So the further out in time a cash flow is, the less you're going to wait. So in order to come up with a time weighted cash flow, all I need to do is take each cash flow and discount it back to today. Now do you see why I had to set things up the way I did? I came up with the cost of capital first, because if I don't have a cost of capital, I can't do this time waiting. So when we look at present value equations, you've never seen any of these equations, have you? Again, that PV button on your calculator basically means you never have to see these equations. I'm still old-fashioned. I prefer equations to PVs. Ask me why. I don't trust the PV function in Excel. I always think it's going to screw me over. So I do the equation. It always gives me the same answer, which is consoling. But these are the equations embedded in your PV function. So basically, if you look at every cash flow you will ever run into in finance, it's on this page. A single cash flow in the future. Take the cash flow, discount it back by 1 plus the discount rate, raise the power, and you got the present value. An annuity, that's a payment button in your calculator. There's the annuity equation. If you want a future value, it's right there. A growing annuity, this is actually not in your calculator. If you want to program it in, do so. What's a growing annuity? You own a gold mine. It produced $3 million in cash flows last year. I expect those cash flows to grow 10% a year for the next 25 years. And I ask you, what's the present value? There are two ways you can compute the present value. One is the long way. Take the cash flow each year, discount each cash flow, add them all up. That'll always give you the right answer, but that's going to mean 25 present values. The other is, you can use this equation. Basically, you put the 10% growth in there, the discount rate, and what you get as a present value will now be the present value of a 25-year growing annuity. And then you have the two equations that can get you into a lot of trouble. The first is called a perpetuity. What's the definition of a perpetuity? Constant cash flow at regular intervals forever. So if I offered you $10 every year forever, that's a perpetuity. It's kind of mind-boggling, because forever, who's going to be around, right? But assume it gets passed on to your descendants and their descendants and so on. The present value of a perpetuity is the cash flow divided by the discount rate. And finally, if you have a growing perpetuity, which is $10 growing at 2% a year forever, there's your present value for growing perpetuity. When we come back from spring break, we're going to use those present value equations to convert those cash flows, those incremental cash flows, into time-weighted numbers. Prices don't include the dividends in Yahoo Finance.
Adjusted, like if I used adjusted closing prices.
But that's not going to include dividends. You'd still have to explicitly bring in the dividends.
Wouldn't the opening close be...
So the closing price will be lower than the opening price in the ex-dividend. But you then have to add the dividend in that day to make it offset.
So wouldn't the adjusted close add dividends and split shares?
No, because it'll adjust for split shares. It won't adjust for dividends. So when you see as a price, that will actually be... The reason they can't is that price has to be a transaction price. So if at the end of my ex-dividend day, I called my broker and said, I want to buy 1,000 shares of the stock. If I include dividends in the price, that price would not be an operable price. So what you see in Yahoo Finance are actual closing prices. When they say adjust for dividends, all they mean is during that day, if there was an ex-dividend, the price would have dropped. So what you're seeing is the adjusted price. So you still have to bring in the dividend. And it's usually every 3 months. It's not a big deal. If you're doing monthly, you'd have to look up what the quarterly dividends were and which months they come in.
I could like plug back in 48.
Exactly. Okay.
Yeah. And, okay, so I'm doing a chocolate company. It's all franchised out. I've gotten...
What is it, C's or...?
Rocky Mountain Chocolate Factory. It's just like microcap.
Okay.
If I've gotten two betas that are like 0.68, 0.75, is that not weird? And
why is it weird when I daily
the beta, it appears when I make it like a daily, it'll become like 0.18 with an R squared of 0.15.
That's the nature of a single regression, right? I mean, strange things are going to happen, any slice of history. Right?
And if I add this in my project, is that something I want to say? Let's look at a bottom-up instead.
The Bloomberg would have the same thing, right?
Right.
It's going to have the same 0.68 or 0.75 if you use the Bloomberg beta.
Is that where I defer to a bottom-up beta?
You always defer to a bottom-up beta, always. Because that's a problem that everyone's going to have. Why is it going to be any different for any other company?
Well, I was confused as to why it would be so low, like a chocolate factory.
Because it's
like
a slice of history, right? What if there was an acquisition during the period? What if there's strange things that happened? What if the management, the CEO got sick for 3 months? You see what I'm saying? All those things can affect a regression beta. Volkswagen having a scandal affects a regression beta.
Okay.
Right? So basically, anytime you do a regression, one slice of history, all that has to happen is something strange
in
that period.
Or in that case, nothing at all.
Or nothing at all.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You want to come up with me? Yeah, just follow me up. Yes?
I cannot find my quiz.
When did you look for it?
Today.
Okay, then come up with me. Do you have a question?
Good question, yeah. Every time you say earnings, you're talking about retained earnings?
No. Your earnings is just operating income or it's a flow.
Just operating incomes without taking
retained earnings is a stock. It shows up in the balance sheet.
Okay.
Earnings is what you see in an income statement.